Information-fueled, opinion-driven. This is the Dan Mandis Show, Super Talk 99.7.
12:05 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. It is the Dan Mandis Show. All eyes, of course, on Georgia for this special election that they're holding right now today. Is this guy John Ossoff what they are calling a Trump killer? We talked about that quite a bit yesterday, and we'll continue to monitor everything that's going on in Georgia today as we find out whether or not the Democrats will be able to put forth their narrative that this is just one of many House seats that they're going to be able to obtain because of the divisive vitriol of Donald Trump. And coming up here in just a mere second or two, David Zanotti is going to join us, of course, co-host of the Public Square, heard on over 200 radio stations across America. And the reason why I wanted to bring on David today is to talk about the ramifications, David, of what's happening in Georgia today. It is one of the biggest stories of the day, politics-wise and overall today. This race for the special election for the 6th congressional district in Georgia, this is traditionally, David, as you know, a Republican-held seat by the likes of Newt Gingrich and current HHS Secretary Tom Price. The Democrats are saying that this is, and it's all about the narrative, David. I think you and I can both agree upon that. We know that this is, again, traditionally a Republican-held seat. Now, the Democrats and the Republicans have both spent millions of dollars, but the Democrats have spent something like $23 million. And a lot of that money, as I detailed yesterday, coming from out of state, states like California, for example. The Republicans have spent about $4.2 million. And I guess the question is, David, we can talk about the narrative and we can also talk about the importance of this special election. But let's talk about the narrative first, because I think that's the most important thing that the Democrats are looking for in this particular race. How important is this race for the Democrats in Georgia?
Well, the Democrats nationally, Dan, are looking for any place they can get a win. They haven't really won in the congressional world since 2008. They lost in 10, 12, 14, 16, and now we're coming up on to 18, so they want to ramp up a head start. So for Georgia Democrats, it's a big deal because they're trying to turn Georgia into from a conservative state into a swing state, and momentum is everything. And then, of course, nationally, it's a big deal because the narrative across the media, that is the progressive media, will simply be that the era of Trump is dead in the cradle. It never got out of 6 months, and Congress is going to turn back in 18. So it's all about momentum.
How important is it to you and also to the Republicans there in Georgia that a lot of this money that is being spent, the $23 million or so that the Democrats are spending for this one congressional seat, even if John Ossoff wins, would you say that that is a true victory for the Democrats, given the fact that this whole narrative that this is the beginning of this wave for the left? They had to spend, $23, $24, $25 million to take this seat away from the Republicans. So would this be a true win from the standpoint of a storyline?
Well, of course, their storyline it will be, but I think the bigger storyline that you're questioning is the historic storyline. What actually do these off-year special elections really indicate in regards to the national referendum that happens in 2018? And Dan, historically, they don't mean much. First off, they're out of time. People will forget all about this by the time we get to the 2018 congressional elections. Secondly, they are inverse. What that means is it's an inverse proportion. In a national election where 435 races are up in the House of Representatives alone and 33 members of the Senate, you have to try to nationalize a race across almost 300 different elections. Here you've got one,
yeah,
or two. So you've got all the focus on one or two. That will not be replicated anywhere in the country in 2018. So they are genuinely one-offs in an off election year. So other than people trying to make a story out of it, it is not honestly the story.
I think one of the other things, too, is the fact that this particular district, and I'm pretty certain that you know that this district has been changing over the years anyway. I mean, this was for many years, a very much of a solid red district. But, you know, the changing demographics of this particular district make it even more of a reasonable scenario that the population in this particular district simply changed, along with some other factors as well. So we have seen some demographical changes as well here in the 6th Congressional District in Georgia. So we'll continue to watch that as the afternoon progresses. Now let's go to Congress, because we know that there are a number of things going on there as well. The current situation in Congress is that the Democrats are effectively, and I guess, David, maybe you can define this a little bit more clearly for us, but what they're doing is they're stopping all business in the Senate, because the Senate Republicans are trying to craft their health care legislation, quote unquote, in private behind closed doors, keeping it under wraps until it's completed. Now, when the House was doing their version, every time news of what was in their version came out, they were attacked by both sides. So you tell me, what's the best way to get the health care reforms done as far as the Senate goes? Is it better to keep everything under wraps until they're completely done and then they could just hand the whole thing over? Or to let some of the facts trickle out, and then every time these facts trickle out, they're going to be, again, attacked on both sides?
Well, again, Dan, really insightful question. If we go back historically, there's no end to the maddening hypocrisy of a United States Senate controlled by Democrats in 2008 and 9 that was working out their health care plan on cocktail napkins. I mean, it's absurd to consider the fact that the Obamacare law, the Affordable Care Act, was passed into final vote before anyone had the opportunity to read what was actually in it. And to this day, they largely haven't, still don't know what's in the bill. So there's a profound amount of hypocrisy about secrecy.
Sure.
However, if the Senate fails to take their final version that they want to bring to a vote and permit it to go through committee hearings, to permit it to go through fair debate in the light of day, then they are making a mistake and they should be torched for it, in the sense of they should be exposed and criticized. Put your ideas on the table. Everybody can see the House bill. Let the process go in a fair, open debate. There's nothing to hide on reforming health care. I can understand why they want to do it quietly until they're ready to fight for the ideas that they've got on paper. That's fair. But once you've got the ideas on paper, bring it to the light of day, let everyone see it, and let everybody have at it. What's to lose?
Is there anything to be said for, okay, let's finish the entire bill, release it, then we discuss the whole thing in its entirety, as opposed to, it almost feels like piecemeal, where these ideas come out and then they're attacked, and then all of a sudden you've got just a tangled web of ideas and everybody's on the defensive, and ultimately then we end up with a complete mess?
Well, there's a good reason for trial ballooning things, because you do want to test ideas and see how much pain they're going to take. But, you know, we've been at this for a long time. This goes back to 1994. This has been on the table and in the debating process since 2008. The House bill is out there for everybody to see. There's not a tremendous amount of mystery here. What it really comes down to is whether or not Republicans who bellyached in the Senate about Obamacare, ran on repealing Obamacare, won on repealing and reforming Obamacare, are now going to actually have the courage to do it, or whether they're going to run and hide from the media and from a few liberal governors who call themselves Republicans, who want federal money to cover over basically being too lazy to fix the program at the bottom the way it should be fixed. So it's politics. It's all politics. The House bill takes us in the right direction. Whether the Senate will continue or whether they'll fold like a cheap chair at the funeral parlor, we don't know. We just don't know.
Well, one of the things that I said to Congressman Scott Desjarlais yesterday, David, was that when the House bill came along, it was almost like, and you remember this because you and I spoke about this, the House bill came along and the Senate basically disregarded pretty much anything the House did. As a matter of fact, the analogy that I've been kind of using to describe this was they basically pat the House Republicans on the head and said, thanks a lot, guys and ladies. We'll take it from here. It was almost egotistical in a way. And now I find that, and I read this morning that Mitch McConnell wants to set a health care vote for before the 4th of July weekend. But couldn't that backfire, David? Because I'm hearing that he doesn't have the votes in the Senate. And then, of course, it does have to go back to the House. Do you see any kind of a scenario where this gets done before the end of summer?
Well, timing is not my strong suit. Dan, because the half timing, you got to be inside their minds and their secret little queries and colloquies and all of that stuff.
Right.
And it's really hard. There's never been a time in American history when the United States Senate didn't think they were smarter than all the rest of us. John Adams talks about it. He said, you know, we could debate in the Continental Congress for weeks on the question of whether 2 + 2 = 4 or not. We would ultimately, or 3 + 2 = 5, we would all ultimately all agree to the same answer, but it would take a week to get there. I mean, this has been going on since the beginning of the American time. So, you know, we just don't know until we don't know. Now, the thing about the Republicans, they might be saying, hey, we're not going to take any more heat for something that's going to fail anyhow.
Right.
And so we're just going to ride this out.
One of the things that you just touched on, I'm going to ask this question from a historical perspective. I know that there's a lot of people that are new, David, to the political process, and they're really now just starting to pay attention because maybe President Trump brought them to the world of politics. And so now they're looking at all of this dysfunction, and maybe they're paying attention more to, say, for example, again, the dysfunction in Congress. And so from a historical perspective, David, are we seeing things in Congress, in the House of Representatives, in the Senate that we have not seen before? Or is this dysfunction pretty much par for the course of what we've seen forever?
Congress has always been a hostile territory, and presidents have always been criticized. We have to remember that Thomas Jefferson accused George Washington in his second term of treason out loud in writing. This has always been a country of great contention when it gets to being split between two political parties. So there is nothing really new here except this factor. We've been able to come together when it really impacts everyone. And we have continued to try to get the right thing done. Now, I don't honestly know whether this Congress has the capacity on the question of health care to actually come together and do what's right, because it's obvious to those of us who don't have a party vested interest, who want to see resolution, that there are ways to work our way out of this situation for the good, for the great good. But it's just a question of whether these politicians are so badly sired, so badly mentally off kilter that they can't do the right thing unless they get the credit. And if that's where we are, then, Dan, I think what ultimately will happen is this Congress will be rejected. I think you'll see people flying out of office left and right, Republican and Democrat, until we get this problem solved. So I think people have had enough of this, and I really do think that, and particularly with this horrific attempted assassination of all these members of Congress, I think people have had enough. This is not a game. We've been talking about the fact that politics every now and then becomes life and death,
right?
And we're there. Yeah. We're there right now.
You know, it's interesting, David, because I had a poll yesterday that I shared with folks, and the poll basically said that Trump was at about 50% approval rating, and so that's pretty good for Donald Trump. But then you looked at the approval rating of people like Nancy Pelosi, people like Chuck Schumer, and a lot of the folks in Congress, and their approval rating is literally in the basement. And so when we talk about how Americans are approving of Congress, clearly Americans are looking at all of this that's going on, and they are, at least according to the polls, and we all know the polls can be right and polls can be wrong, and different polls can say different things, but it's pretty clear that Americans are getting kind of ticked off at what they're seeing. We've heard the term, of course, do nothing Congress. We have lots of issues and agenda items not being tackled, including, by the way, tax reforms as well as they try and push through health care. Now the GOP is, from what I understand, David, and I talked about this yesterday, considering canceling their August recess to try and salvage their agenda. Again, I was talking about that poll that showed that Americans have a really low opinion of Congress. Trump is polling higher. So I guess the ultimate question is, and you talked about how folks are going to be flying out of Congress, flying out of Washington, D.C. in 2018 and 2020. Ultimately, David, the answer to the question is, who will get the blame if none of these items get done? Will it be President Trump? Will it be the Democrats, the Freedom Caucus, or the moderate Republicans?
Well, the question underneath that question, Dan, is who will be able to nationalize the next election on either blame or credit? There are times when elections don't come down to blame or credit. I'll give you an example. Scott Desjarlais is very popular in Middle Tennessee. He's a part of the more conservative side of the United States Congress. His people support him, and they are going to most likely support him no matter how badly Congress screws it up, because they know it's not Scott's fault. He's given it the best he can. The same thing with Jim Jordan in Ohio, for example, or Trent Franks in Arizona. So it all depends,
yeah,
to create a wave election in Congress on whether or not there can become a national blame or a national credit. Now, what's really tragic is right now, the people that Congress pays to be their consultants and the political parties are sitting back figuring out how they can build the leverage in 18 to set the narrative so that they catch the wave, not solve a problem. And that's why people are so mad at Congress, because they stopped solving problems and they're only there to hold on to power. They elected Donald Trump because they thought Trump might be a problem solver, and unfortunately they're discovering now, to their demise, that if you have one problem solver surrounded by 535 people looking for credit or blame, you don't get any problems solved.
Well, it's funny. We've got all these really important foreign policy issues going on right now, plus, again, we've got tax reforms, domestic issues. Does the president, with all of these flippant investigations going on and everything that's going on in America right now, does President Trump have anywhere to maneuver in, I guess, the next year, certainly, but also in the next 3.5 years? I mean, where does he take all this? I mean, he's bogged down in all these investigations, and I think probably it's going to be the way things are going, one investigation after another, and these investigations are going to start piling up, whether it's President Trump or whether it is his inner circle. So what does the president do? How does he react to all this? I mean, you just said that the president was hired, if you will. He was voted in because folks thought he was a problem solver. But you've got this swamp that is very deep and very murky indeed. So do you see the president being able to break through all this? And how will the American voters feel about President Trump if this is pretty much the narrative for the next 3.5 years?
Dan, the problem is you ask me these provocative questions that are so on point, but they take a long time to answer. Now, I've got to figure out, give you 1 minute.
Yes.
Here's what Donald Trump needs to do.
All right.
And by the way, I love the questions. Your listeners are blessed just to hear the questions. Here's what Donald Trump needs to do. If I could tell Donald Trump what to do, and by the way, he's not going to do this, okay?
Right.
I'm sorry. He's not going to do it. Nobody ever does. His move is against Congress. What Donald Trump needs to do right now is rally all his richest buddies, create a super PAC that's got $500 million in it, and turn around and go out right now and attack every congressional district they want to win on their agenda and move people into the primary process, support people in the general election, or oppose those in the general election as they see fit. They need to go after reforming Congress themselves. Nobody ever has the courage to do it. It's what has to be done. And until somebody's willing to force us back to the congressional question, the president's just going to be sitting there languishing, no matter whether he's Barack Obama or Donald Trump. They're both in the same boat until Congress turns.
David, what's coming up on the public square on Sunday morning at 6 here on WTN?
We have got a tremendous program on Bernie Sanders this week and a confrontation that Bernie Sanders had. That's the one that's up right now. The one that's coming is an exclusive interview with David McCullough on his new book, The American Spirit. That's what's coming up this weekend on the public square. So two great shows, one up now and the other one coming up on WTN Sunday morning at 6 with David McCullough.
All right. And that is David Zanotti. David, always appreciate your analysis. 1222 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. 1236 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. It is the Dan Mandis Show. What a horrible story this. Otto Warmbier, and I want to bring on a guy who has been on the show a couple of times now, Jacob Bogle. And Jacob, you are someone who has spent many, many years studying North Korea. So I wanted to bring you on and talk a little bit about the case of Otto Warmbier, because I know that this is a situation where I'm not exactly sure why it is, Jacob, that folks continuously want to go to North Korea and why there are some nations that are allowing this to go on. So let's dig a little bit deeper beyond the headline into the death of Otto Warmbier. Now, we know that he passed away after 17 months doing hard labor in North Korea. The most obvious question has been, why are there still people going to North Korea? Let's start out with Otto. Why was he in North Korea?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
Sure.
He was actually traveling in China, and the decision to visit North Korea seems to have been fairly impulsive after he saw an advertisement from a tour agency. And North Korea holds a certain allure for many. You know, it's a unique country. It can offer a lot in the way of throwback Soviet-style culture that's mixed with ancient Korean history. And several hundred Americans and a few thousand Westerners visit every year. For the most part, they leave people alone, but not always.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that, because I know that you said that you just said he was visiting China, then he made an impulsive and clearly life-altering move to go and visit North Korea. And then he was accused of stealing a propaganda banner. What's the story behind that headline? Did he really steal a propaganda banner?
Well, there is video of someone taking a banner down off of a hotel wall in a staff-only area, but all you see is a black silhouette of a man. From the video, you can't tell who it is. So whether or not he did it, I don't know, but he was certainly accused of it and was convicted.
Now, one of the things that I've been reading all of this, Otto and others have to go through this third-party country, China, for example. And so they have to go through a group that goes through China. The news prompted a group called Young Pioneer Tours. The Beijing-based company that organized Warren Beer's North Korea trip has now announced they're going to stop taking U.S. citizens on tour to the country. But this and other groups, I mean, they take thousands of people to North Korea every year, and it's a pretty big business for North Korea. And they're saying that they're going to try and talk through this with their Korean travel partners. How much does North Korea make on visitors and tourists going into their country? I mean, how big of a business is it for them?
Well, it's many millions. Even the smaller, cheaper packages to go over there cost thousands of dollars. When you go to, a gift shop or a restaurant or whatever, you're paying in hard currency. So it's a big business for sure.
And who are these folks that are going into North Korea? I read that, about 90 to 94, 95% of them are Chinese. Who are the other folks? I mean, obviously, we have some Americans for whatever reason going over there. We'll delve into that in a second, because I know you mentioned a couple of things. But who's going to North Korea?
You've got Russians. Of course, they have a historical tie with the Soviet Union. Other people from European countries, Australia. North Korea is just one of those unique places that just draw people for some reason. And so they come from all over.
I guess the other question I would ask is, we've seen this before. We've seen where North Korea ends up taking prisoners and so forth. When they sign up for these tours, I mean, do they have to sign some sort of a disclaimer saying you might end up with, over a decade of hard labor?
Well,
do something perceived as wrong?
Right. Well, that's why people are encouraged to use tour groups, because usually they sit you down and go through the risks and the do's and do nots. The problem with this particular company, though, was that they used basically deceptive marketing to make the risks associated with going to North Korea seem less likely, as though they somehow held sway with North Korean government. And, if you use this particular company, you are less likely to be harassed or arrested. But that's just not the case with any of them.
All right. So let's talk about the more awkward part of the interview, which is the experience for folks that are behind bars in North Korea. And of course, we know that Otto Warmbier, he had been sentenced to, can't remember what his original sentence was, but, he had basically spent, 17 months doing hard labor in North Korea. So what are these labor camps like in North Korea? What exactly is it that these folks are doing in these labor camps? Obviously, hard labor, I know that. But, we've all seen the old movies where you've got these folks that are crushing rocks and that kind of thing. What's this experience like in North Korea?
Well, he was sentenced to 15 years hard labor. And they treat the Americans a little bit differently than the average person in a prison camp, but it's still horrific. Usually hard labor involves working in agriculture or in a mining operation, but there's a lack of equipment, which means you're just using brute human strength, things like ox carts and hand tools to farm the land, very medieval technology. And the mining is done with little to no safety of collapses are really common. Prisoners are forced to work up to 15 hours a day every day. They receive less than 400 grams of food rations, which gives you a maximum of 1,500 calories a day to work 15 hours a day. That means, you know, prisoners are going to find mice, bugs, even weeds to supplement their diets. And when you add non-existent sanitation, you know, under those conditions, the body starts to fall apart really quickly.
All right, so let me ask you a couple of different questions here. People love when I do that. You'll get used to it. One, do we know what specifically was Otto's task? Was he working in a mine? Was he working agriculture? That's going to be part one of the question. And part two of the question is, you said that Americans are treated, I think you said, slightly different or differently. Is it safe to assume that Americans are treated worse in North Korea than, say, these prisoners from other countries?
Well, for the last part of your question, there aren't many prisoners from other countries. So as far as, you know, foreigners go.
Okay.
His actual task, we don't know. After, I think it was about 6 months of being in prison, he came down with a coma for some reason.
Yeah.
So we're not really sure what he was doing.
All right. So you talked about how there are no, and by the way, the official reason, I guess it was at the North Koreans, Jacob, that said that it was botulism.
Right.
Somehow he ended up in a coma. Now, I don't know if botulism can put you into a coma, but clearly something happened to Otto Warmbier. And I think it was laughable when the North Koreans said something about, well, we're releasing him on humanitarian grounds so that he can be with his family. It's like, the dude came out of your country with a coma, for the love of Pete. So let's talk a little bit about the people that are being held right now in North Korea. How many American prisoners are there? And I know it's a secretive country, but I know that last time I read, there's about three or four. Is there more than that?
There's three Americans currently, and all three are Korean Americans, and all three are charged with crimes relating to missionary work, which is something North Korea takes very, very seriously.
So describe that for me. So in other words, if these are Korean Americans, then are these folks that were born in Korea and they have, you know, they go back and forth and then they end up doing and working for these ministries and then they go to North Korea, and what are they doing? Like handing out Bibles and preaching? What are they doing?
Well, one did leave a Bible in the bathroom, which is something you simply do not do. A lot of other times, though, it's simply people that are working, you know, with education or getting food aid and things like that into the country. And the North Koreans, for whatever reason, will, you know, pick one that has a connection to a church or a ministry and will charge them with, you know, undermining the state by, you know, trying to spread religion.
Jacob Bogle joins us, and he is an expert and an analyst on North Korea. And Jacob, I guess the other question I would have is, so you have all of these ministries and they're tied to churches. At what point do churches just need to stop sending their teams there, their ministries, to North Korea? Because clearly this is something that's dangerous. And also I know that there's, if I'm not mistaken, have there been some professors that have also been picked up as well in North Korea? At what point do Americans or Korean Americans just stop going to North Korea and just hanging back here in the United States, or going to countries where they're not going to get arrested and having to spend, you know, decades in hard labor?
Well, that's part of, you know, the threat analysis that every individual has to look at. I think the threat has been partially overblown. Since 1999, there have only been 16 Americans detained, and Otto is the first death. The percentage risk is like 0.4%. But, you know, if you're going, you know, as a Christian, if you're going, then you have, you know, this higher calling on your mind, to, you know, that compels you to go. And you've got arguments, you know, that people shouldn't visit because you're giving money to an evil regime. But there's also a counter argument that defends travel because you're exposing North Koreans to different people and ideas, which over time, you know, can help weaken the leadership and hopefully, lead to the country, coming out from this nightmare.
Let me ask you, Jacob, what's in it for North Korea? I mean, we know that they've got, you know, they had Otto Warmbier for, what, 17 months, and they've got the United States, and we've got all these different situations with North Korea, whether or not, you know, the ballistic missile testing and their relationship with China and all these other things. So you've got all of that as a backdrop, and I've covered all those things, but we've got all these things as a backdrop. What is in it for North Korea to keep a guy like Otto Warmbier when they've got all of these other things that are swirling around them as well? What's it going to hurt for them to simply release this guy? Is this a situation where, with Kim Jong-un, it makes him look more powerful because he's holding some of these Americans, and specifically Otto Warmbier, an American college student? Does it make him look more important to his people that he's holding an American like Otto?
Absolutely. They basically use prisoners as pawns. A lot of times when someone is released, it happens whenever a high-profile politician or former official paid a visit. And so that confers a level of legitimacy to the regime. And sometimes North Korea actually, gets some kind of concession in return. So it's definitely a benefit to the North.
So is it any coincidence that Otto Warmbier was released when Dennis Rodman, I think it was the day that Dennis Rodman arrived in North Korea. Was that a coincidence, or was it just that they realized that he was very much near death and they didn't want him to die on North Korean soil, so they sent him back home?
It could be a coincidence. Nobody knows if Dennis Rodman played a role. Rodman does consider Kim Jong-un a friend for some reason.
That is an oddest. That is so weird, and that's also part of my question is, do we know what Dennis Rodman, I haven't really heard much about this since Rodman arrived in North Korea. Is he still there? Was there anything accomplished? What's going on with Dennis Rodman's trip to go see his BFF, Kim Jong-un?
Nothing has been accomplished that I'm aware of. Kim Jong-un is a huge basketball fan, and they got along fairly well the last time Rodman was over there. So this could just be, a pleasure outing for Rodman.
The scary thing for Dennis Rodman is one of the things that he did was, didn't he give a book, one of President Trump's books, to Kim Jong-un or somebody that was over there that he met with? I saw the picture. But, isn't that dangerous for Dennis Rodman to present such a book to the leaders there in North Korea? Because, for all I know, that could be perceived as some sort of a threat, and he could end up in hard labor.
Well, I think in his case, he's a little bit too high profile to arrest. The last time he went over there, for one of the last days that he was going to be there, he was actually supposed to meet Kim Jong-un at his private ski resort. But the night before, Rodman got so drunk that the security guards didn't want, an incident to happen. Maybe Rodman giving him a big kiss or something. And so he was politely declined that meeting. So I think they handle him, with a little different, or with a bit of deference than they would another person.
Interesting. So I guess the final couple questions here is, can or should the United States do something or anything to get these three remaining Korean Americans home? I know that, that is only going to play into the hands of Kim Jong-un, right?
It could very well. Anytime something like this happens, work happens or begins, from day one behind the scenes. Since we don't have diplomatic relations with North Korea, Sweden acts as our protecting power over there, and so we do a lot of negotiations through them.
All right, Jacob Bogle. Jacob, I appreciate it. I got to run, unfortunately. Great talking to you, as always. And Jacob's website is jacobbogle.com, North Korean analyst and also blogger. Spent many years studying North Korea, and I always appreciate Jacob's input on these issues. And I appreciate him calling in. 12:51 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN.
Coming up, I have details on the officer-involved shooting. Well, very little details, but I'll have details on the officer.
Way to sell it, Pamela. Shooting. Way to sell it. Boy, I got to tell you.
In Williamson County.
That's it. I'm on the verge of possibly doing a topic where I may have topic regret.
Oh, let's do it.
Oh, my
Please?
Lord. I can't believe the headline I've got coming up for you next on Super Woo-hoo! Talk 99.7 WTN.